I read this equation somewhere, so it's like a mathematical formula that happiness is equal to results minus expectations. Now, if the expectations are higher, your happiness is going to go into negative. If your results are higher, then your happiness is going to go into positive. But the key here is you hold the key for happiness, and if that's your ultimate goal, then might as well work towards realistic expectations and work towards results rather than keeping your expectations high.
Hello and welcome to Fixing the Bug, powered by Code Quotient. A podcast where we talk about everything coding, be it the teaching methods and learnings, job opportunities and market trends, or business opportunities and building a company. Today we are in conversation with Ketan Sharma, who is currently the Vice President of Global Operations for Ensemble India, a technology acceleration company that codes for health. So, Ketan, hi. Thank you for taking time out for this conversation. How have you been?
Hi, Shivangi. Yeah, thank you for having me in this program. I've been good. Things have been quite exciting, specifically from a professional point of view. So, yeah, all's good.
Sounds exciting for the conversation. But we'll take it from the start. So, what made you venture into technology? What brought you closer to it?
I've been an engineer by profession. My professional career started as a software developer, and I had gone to do my post-graduation, and then I started working for a company called Mid-Counties Co-op, which kind of laid the foundation of how I perceive technology and how it operates. Through that journey itself, I kind of, through my work tenure, I ended up creating a couple of products which kind of helped me ease develop my own software. So, for example, I wrote a software program that would write code for me, so you know, I didn't have to write it myself. And that, I think, kind of laid the foundation of...
You wrote a program that writes code for you?
Yeah, I mean, in those days, there were a couple of products in the market that used to do that. So essentially, when you write a program, you write data into a database, and then you read data from a database. So this wasn't any different from what the other products were doing. This would just look at the database and whatever needs to be done from a point of view of storing data and retrieving data, I would just sort of write that piece of code. And I kind of reduced my code writing time by almost 70%. So I call me lazy or creative, but you know, it kind of helped me write code pretty fast. And that kind of helped because we were a very small team of software developers, and we used to write complex workflows, and most of them used to only have writing data into a database and showing data from a database. So, you know, it kind of sped up quite a few things. Then there were occasions when the server would go down and I had to sort of, you know, 2-3 o'clock at night, go back and switch on the server again virtually. Again, just to save on my own personal time, I wrote a piece of code that would check if the server is down continuously for an amount of time, and it would just go and reboot the server.
That's a classic example of smart work.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, technology is supposed to help you overcome inefficiencies. And I think when you sort of work towards building smarter products, they make your life easy. Look at the products that are there around you, Uber, Airbnb, social media platforms. All of them are kind of making our lives easy so that we could do more productive work. Now it is, you know, a matter of debate whether we do something with our free time or not. But that's I think what technology's real purpose is to empower you, and that's what happened. So it was exciting. I mean, product development, even things like when I was staying in UK, I wasn't very good with money, so I wrote a program that would help me analyze my bank statements to help me understand where I was spending the most. So in those days, we could download Excel-based files. That would kind of, help me understand, those little fancy charts that you see today in your, banking apps. You know, I kind of worked on them up front just for my own personal use. None of these products were actually meant for, you know, solving other people's problems unless they wanted me to do so. But, you know, generally, in some form or shape, they were helping me solve my own problems.
But that's very important that you utilize your theoretical knowledge and use it for practical gains. It might not have been for any monetary gains for you, but it helped your life out and eventually helped you perfect your skills. because you were working on
Yeah,
it then.
absolutely. And you know, I think I kind of carried that. So you remember I wrote this program that wrote code for the first 5 years of my entrepreneurship journey. Actually, that laid the foundation of all my employees who were writing code. It actually cut down their production time by 70% as well. So not only did it make my life easy when I was writing code myself, but it also kind of reduced my production costs when I started my own business. I mean, I didn't think of it like that back then. But now I definitely realize, you know, sometimes you write something and you create something and, you know, sometimes you think, oh, you know, I don't know if that was a real productive use of my time. But, you know, when you connect the dots back, you realize how each of those, you know, efforts in building something or creating something kind of helped you through your journey.
Hard work pays off no matter in which direction you put it. Eventually, it should be for the good use, but yes, it does pay off. So talking about your journey starting Fifth Note, how did you switch from job to entrepreneurship?
It kind of happened. It is not as sort of, you know, enlightening as me waking up one fine morning thinking, no, I have to do something in my life and, you know, go ahead and start a company.
Right.
It kind of just happened. And if I was to put it down, so we were staying in the UK and we had family here who needed looking after. I had a proper settled job with the house and everything there. But then, you know, we always felt a little empty. And right from the start, I did have this entrepreneurial bug in me. Because before going to the UK or doing my master's, I had actually failed a startup, a services company before going. And then when I went there, I also did quite a few odd projects, which kind of made, you know, a lot of money for me at that point in time when I needed it the most. So, you know, it's when we thought of coming back to India, it was mostly personal. And when I came back and I looked at the job scene, the job market, I stay in a place called Chandigarh. It's a small town. And, you know, the opportunities as far as the job scene is concerned was not in sync with what I had already experienced working there in UK. So I decided to, you know, pick up contractual work, and then one thing led to the other. The contracts became bigger. The penalty clauses in those contracts became pretty heavier. Then I registered a company because I didn't want to take, you know, any legal hits directly on my name. And then the work got bigger. We became from one to two. And then, you know, I was operating from my home, from a small room, and we landed up a big contract through references for a US Texas based firm, which wanted us to write a program to connect all the gas pipelines together. And it was a very intimidating sort of a project, and I had never worked on something like that before. But yeah, I mean, one thing led to the other. I tried to engage with smarter developers than myself who could come in and work on these technically sort of strong projects. And, you know, eventually it kind of grew bigger. I mean, we had our ups and downs through that journey, but I think persistence kind of paid off.
So, like you said, that there was this big project you had never worked upon before, like you had not ventured into that territory. So when you get such projects that you have not thought of before and never practiced on before, what gives you that intuition ki acha, okay, fine, I shall do it, I shall pick it up, and I would be able to finish the task?
I think belief definitely plays a big part in it. I don't think anything is impossible unless people show the patience for you to complete the job. If you know, you say, yeah, I can do it, it's a matter of figuring out. I mean, look at jobs. We go into jobs without that particular experience, but we still end up doing it anyway. So this is no different. So if you look at from an experience point of view, you can gain experience only by doing something you've not done before. So, you know, this was like, oh, I've never done this before, so I better start looking into it. Then it's a matter of problem solving. In fact, my life's mantra is that, you know, if the biggest skill you can learn is problem solving. And this was just another problem to solve.
Okay, so you started with Fifth Note in 2012, and then it was acquired by Ensemble Health in 2020. First of all, what does Ensemble Health does, and what's your role as a partner with it?
Ensemble was pretty interesting, and they came in at a point when we were pretty much wrapping up because it was becoming extremely difficult to survive on these small projects. I had lost a contract, and we were struggling to, you know, even pay up for our infrastructure. So we moved into a co-working space. You know, Ensemble came to us through an interesting proposition. So my partner at that point in time had done a small piece of work for one of the key product designers in Ensemble. And he was interested in engaging with my partner. And my partner mentioned that, look, I work for this company and we take on services work. So why don't you give us the job and we'll do it for you? And we were assuming that it'll be like, you know, one or two people. Their initial request came with 10 people and we were just four people at that point in time. So coming back to what Ensemble does, Ensemble is a revenue cycle management company. To simply explain what they do, in the healthcare in US is primarily insurance dominated. And, you know, you would know that anyone and everyone there holds an insurance policy when it comes to healthcare. So when somebody goes to a hospital and they get treated, you know, they leave an insurance number behind and then now it's up to the healthcare provider to get their money from the insurance company. Now, as simple as it might sound, it is a very, very tedious process and sometimes can take up to more than 6 months for you to retrieve your own money. And that creates a lot of cash flow issues for hospital companies. So Ensemble comes in as a third party. Essentially, all they do is collect that money from an insurance company and give it back to the hospital and they gain commission. And as a part of that workflow, what sets them apart is that they reduce the cycle time. What I mean by cycle time is if it takes you 6 months to retrieve the money, we'll get you the money in 30 days. And the other is, obviously, insurance companies are not interested in giving the money back. So, you know, yield, which is like how much money have you been able to collect per claim, also becomes an interesting aspect. So sometimes insurance companies only pay you partially. They don't pay you completely. Sometimes they actually deny your claim, which you have to appeal for and then get your money back. So all of these processes are done by Ensemble. Ensemble is a phenomenal success story. I mean, starting with like a few hundred people, they are now grown into size 10,000 in US. Our engineering unit here is about 300, but you know, we were 50 when we got acquired and I kind of grew it up to 300. And, you know, they are now valued at $5.2 billion. And they're filing for an IPO pretty soon, I hope. I think that in a couple of years' time, they will be filing for an IPO. Aiming for a $20 billion valuation. So it's a phenomenal case study on how they've tapped into this opportunity. And they're right now number three in the market. And in spite of the fact that they are valued at nearly $5 billion, you know, the three large competitors in this space have only captured 20% of the market. So you can imagine the extent of the opportunity still available.
So after being a part of Ensemble Health, has there been any organizational shift to fit the new demands or policies apart from growing the company and increasing the employment workforce?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were a very small company and we were operating not too heavily by virtue of processes, but mostly based out of instinct, you know, being very agile and nimble around what's beneficial for our clients. We used to serve like more than two, three separate clients at that point in time. Again, we were not really into quantity that much ever. We were always into quality and that kind of helped us stay profitable irrespective of how many contracts we did. But the changes primarily were to do with, you know, getting this mind shift around how do you organize yourself or rather reorganize yourself for scale. You know, being a small company and being a startup, chaos is prevalent. You are primarily in search mode and you're looking for the right product market fit or a service market fit. But once you get that product market fit and service market fit, essentially what you need to do is revisit your entire organization, redefine all the roles which set the foundation for scale, because now the problem that you need to solve is a little different. So I think largely the change that came in with Ensemble's acquisition of IfNode is coaching, you know, me and you know, the rest of the top leadership on how to reorganize yourself for scale. So a lot of processes came in, a lot of policies came in, which kind of helped us grow into what we are today.
Okay. So how was your experience of this change?
The experience was very, very interesting. I kind of had tasted both the aspects of entrepreneurial growth, one to do with, you know, being in the industry long enough to find a service market fit, which I think I still was kind of struggling with. But then post-acquisition, you know, having that experience of how do you reorganize yourself? How do you create an org structure? How do you create an operational structure? How do you set, you know, processes around hiring? How do you hire top talent? How do you hire leadership? How do you interview leadership? How do you retain talent? Or what does talent management cater to? How do you define your measures of success? And how do you sort of create coherence within your teams to, in a very unified way, look at those measurements of success and work towards the same vision? All of that was something that I got exposed to. So the experience was very good. But again, I also learned how to let go. I mean, this is a company that is not mine anymore. Most of the decisions are not mine anymore. And I don't necessarily agree with certain approaches that are being taken by, you know, these amazing, talented leaders. Because I had my own approach on how I would solve those particular pieces of the puzzle. But, you know, when you get into that sort of a hierarchical situation, then obviously you've got to be a team player and understand what, where are they coming from, what are they trying to do. So the change was kind of a mixed bag. On the one end, I was, you know, extremely happy about all this new learning that was coming my way. On the other hand, I was a little confused about the mixed emotions I was feeling while letting go.
Okay, so this, what you talked about just now, that you have to retain the talent and you have to acquire the talent and you have to make sure that there is a harmony amongst the people who are working together. So do you happen to have, now that you have worked on this for 2 years, do you happen to have any go-to ideals to make sure that everything is coherent and the teamwork is proper?
I think keeping it simple is the biggest and the most misunderstood secret of scale. People tend to complicate because I think our minds are programmed to get impressed by complicated things. So we tend to overcomplicate our structure. We tend to overcomplicate our process. And it comes at the cost of coherence and communication. I think one principle that I stick to is how to look at a complicated situation and try to simplify, because when you simplify and explain it to your team members, they look at it simply as well. And then, you know, they all intuitively start operating on it. So coherence kind of automatically comes in. So that, I think, is the one principle I stick to. How do I simplify things for me and my colleagues?
Okay. And talking about your role as the VP of Global Operations, could you tell us more about it?
I'm trying to figure it out myself, but I think one of the things is that, you know, my engineering had some limitations in terms of how the discipline needs to be in terms of reshaping and reorganizing the engineering teams so that it could be more conducive to product development. Because essentially, we are developing a product. We are a, you know, a technology-based services company. What we do is we build a product for our own self so that our services become a lot easier. Similar to what I kind of did for myself, I wrote a piece of code that helped me increase my own efficiency. You know, looking back at that, I think Ensemble's main forte and the team that they are trying to pull through is essentially key in this entire development. And as a VP global sourcing or global technology partner, my role kind of then evolves into my core expertise, which is more around operational scale. So, you know, if we look at Ensemble's journey, they have reached, you know, 5 billion in terms of valuation. They are now focused on building and restructuring their engineering so that they could build technology which can help them do whatever they do faster and also do whatever they do with less number of errors so that, you know, they can increase their gains. And that will push them to be number one. But once the technology is developed, you know, you would need more people. If you look at their numbers today, operationally, they're about 10,000 people in US. And, you know, as the technology equips people, they would want to expand operationally so that more work can be done leveraging off this technology. So like I mentioned that I developed that piece of code that wrote code for me, that kind of helped to solve like 70%, putting in 70% efficiency, but the rest 30% had to be done by a human. There was no escape from that. And I think as a global sourcing partner, my job would be to expand on that, 30% manual work and find more people for them.
So now that we are talking about coding and operational aspect of it all, what do you think is the key to sticking in the industry in the long run?
Just offer value. There is no secret sauce to this. People tend to forget that, you know, keeping things simple and offering value is very easily identified by people who are scouting for it. When you want to stay in the industry, and this is one topic that is close to my heart, I think specifically the workforce that is available in India is confused about what they understand as far as growth is concerned. So I'm guessing this is where that question is of sticking around is coming from, as to how do you grow in this particular area. I mean, if this is an industry that you are excited about, if this is something that you're passionate about and you start offering value, it'll be like, oh, I've developed a piece of code that was there in my work days. And who knew that that would, you know, offer value at a point when I most needed it during my entrepreneurship and reduce my production costs. So another thing that I feel is that people confuse growth with economic prosperity. In India, I believe specifically the younger workforce are very, very poor financial planners. The reason why they move jobs or stick around is because they need more money. And the reason why they need more money is because they have a poor sense of financial planning. They've got more money going out that they are earning. And to reduce that gap, I think they start either looking for an industry which has quote unquote a higher package, or you know, they start jumping within jobs. And that's what creates a lot of gap between a workforce that adds value and offers value and a workforce which is just creating a perception of experience so that, you know, they can get higher jobs. So in my view, you know, understanding what you really enjoy doing. If you enjoy doing working in technology, then, you know, automatically the value would come out and automatically someone will identify you, because I know they're looking.
But I think when it comes down to this behavioral pattern that people are switching jobs, are they taking jobs just because it pays well, comes from the fact that we as a society have always functioned in a manner that if you are economically sound, you are settled, you are successful, and you're doing well in life.
Yeah, yeah. By no means am I saying that you don't need to work towards economic security. And I'm not saying that. But that can't be the only reason for your growth. That is a byproduct that comes as a result of value offering. But if the, you know, economic security becomes the only goal, then there are other ways to do it also. What happens is people are trying to gain economic security in the technology industry, whereas they are not really passionate about technology. So then they get confused. And not only themselves, they end up confusing everybody else around them as well.
Right.
So it is important, absolutely important, but it is equally important for you to know, sort of achieve the same goal doing something that you're really passionate about.
So the learnings that you have, that to be able to love the thing that you're doing and be consistent in your approach and lead a simplified life, from where does all these things come from? Have you have had any such experience, like any memorable meeting, any memorable interview that taught you a few aspects of it?
The biggest and the last experience that I've had is of being acquired. So when you are always led to believe that economic security and making money is the primary goal, when you make it, then you're thinking, okay, what do I do now?
What next?
And that's a pretty dark corner, you know, and then that is when you suddenly realize that, oh, this is something that I was running after, which wasn't really the ultimate goal. I just thought it was the ultimate goal. So from an entrepreneurship point of view, if you look at my experience, you know, I kind of closed the loop. You know, I started a company, I sold it profitably. And, you know, I've kind of been exposed to a very unique industry in the US market. And, you know, now I'm sort of working towards scale leading leaders, and also, you know, understanding the fundamentals of organizational scale. But then at the same point, you know, you kind of realize working with top leadership as well, how confused and complicated they make, you know, this entire journey in life. And if only things were simpler, your entire journey can be a lot more enjoyable, and you can define your own metrics for progress, not really success, you know. So, for example, if someone wants to lose weight, setting a goal of 10 kilos, you know, could be limiting. But saying I'm going to lose half a kilo every month, or a kilo every month, is more progressive, you know, and more healthy. Because A, you're not killing yourself trying to achieve an unrealistic target. You're not impressing anyone. B, you know, you can sort of enjoy the process as you go through it, right? So my experience through the acquisition was pretty daunting. You know, I've gone through my ups and downs, my own insecurities about what will happen next, or the fact that I would feel, oh, you know, once I've acquired and made the money, then I'll work fearlessly. I think that's the biggest myth of all time, is that once you make the money, you stop being fearful. I think it goes the other way around. So you become, now you've got more to lose. So, you know, not just money, but you've created an image. You've created a sense of responsibility, which is 10 times larger than what you had before. And, you know, you are now 10 times more fearful, you know. So it kind of dawns on you that what you thought were life's objectives weren't really life's objectives. And those kind of, that is a very humbling experience. When you come across that, and you sort of revisit your so-called goals of life, and then try to reorganize it according to what you think now really matters. But it's an ever-evolving journey. I think people have to go through that cycle to actually understand it. And another thing that works in my favor is I don't end up judging people because they operate in that mode. You know, they're operating in that mode because they haven't been through that cycle. If they go through that cycle, they will understand automatically. So you have to be patient about everybody's journey. You know, they're all reaching the same point. It's just that some is sooner, some is later. Eventually, they all get there.
But having had such a varied amount of experience throughout and going through the cycle, do you happen to have any incident or experience that made you say, oh, thank God I failed here. Thank God I did not succeed in this.
Loads of them. There were occasions when I would desperately try to win a contract and I would not get it because, you know, I would realize that probably I didn't even have the capacity to actually deliver, and it would have screwed up things for me on fronts where I was actually delivering as well. Off the top of my head, I can't really think of any specific instances as such, but, you know, there are loads of examples of events that have happened that kind of taught me the value of, you know, enough. And it's like, you know, you end up sort of losing what you have and what you need for something that you don't have and you don't need.
Oh, wow. That's a great line.
Yeah, I read it in one of the books, and I think it kind of stuck with me, because you need to understand that with a sense of comparison, specifically socially, you can never hit the ceiling. You know, you'll always keep chasing this ghost. You will never get there. So I think having a sense of enough kind of helps you take those kind of decisions where you feel, oh, okay, it's good, it didn't happen, right? So it's not just a compromise, but it's also learning that valuable lesson of life that, okay, maybe it wasn't meant to be, and what I have is enough, so it's okay.
So these things, that good that did not happen, or what I have is enough, comes after we have passed through that phase. So when you are in a zone where things are not working out, where you do not think that this is the right path that should be followed, what is your go-to thing of dealing with them?
So people have different ways of sort of dealing through it. Mine, funnily, is a cup of coffee. So I am an avid, I love coffee as a subject, and I love the process of coffee. So, you know, you can do a PhD in this subject. So the very mention of the word coffee has made you smile, I think. So that has, that's the kind of impact that I'm talking about. So every morning I love to sort of, I have these coffee beans that I order specifically for myself according to my taste. And I've got this manual coffee grinder that I use So cafes and coffee as a subject is something that helps me sort of take a strategic pause, so to speak. And strategic pauses are like rest days from a gym, if you know that. So you work out your muscle for so long, you feel, oh, this is not getting anywhere, and I feel tired and I feel ached. So then it is important that you take a strategic pause to sort of rebuild your strength and go back to the whole thing again. So it's not necessary that you have to go through that cycle. This can be a way of life. Sometimes people can listen to all of this and say, you know, what the hell do you know? You made it already, right? So I am still working towards that. It's easy for you to think like this. So, and it's understandable. Again, this is that dream that I'm talking about, because I used to think in the same way. But life has its own ways and techniques, Shivangi, of teaching you this principle. When, how, you don't know. But I sincerely hope and pray that everybody goes through it, because it's a very, very nice journey of evolution that helps you redefine your values in life and truly shows you what you want to really experience, you know, life as. So traveling definitely helps, but I realized that traveling became a route of escape for me. I was traveling to run away from my problems only to come back to it. And you know, especially when you have the resources, it becomes even easier. And rather than facing your problems, create distractions for yourself. And that doesn't really qualify as a strategic pause. That's just escaping. So
I'm guilty of that.
Yeah, it happens. It happens. Again, we are all humans. We have our own ways of dealing with our situations. But sitting in a nice cafe of your choice, sipping coffee just by yourself, you know, doing that self-talk where you're trying to understand, okay, how am I going to get out of this and solve this problem for myself, is a much better way to come out of your problems than going to a nice beach and sort of getting yourself distracted and getting depressed on the last day when you have to return back, because you know subconsciously you're coming back to the same shit you ran away from.
Because you mentioned this, going to a cafe, sitting and sipping coffee by yourself, this incident really happened with me. I did not plan to do it, but I was not in a good set of mind frame, and I somehow locked myself out of the house. Instead of taking the house keys, I took my car key and I closed the door, and it was automatic lock, so it got locked. Then I had to wait for my brother to come back because he had another key. So what would I do in this time frame of an hour or two? I went to the nearby cafe. And I did it after approximately 6-7 months. I sat by myself, had a cup of, I did not have coffee, but I had lemonade. Even after that, I was able to think more clearly and feel a bit happier about life when I did that. So it really, like, it helps. It helped me. It helps you. Maybe it helps more people around.
Absolutely. I think people underestimate the power of spending time with yourself. And we are always in fight to sort of create distractions for ourselves, whether we start looking at Instagram reels or whether we start talking to people on WhatsApp or we start reading through some junk online or just idling around. But I think creating time for yourself on your calendar through the day, taking out time to reflect, has been the biggest source of efficiency for me, at least. You know, people who have very, very busy calendars, who don't have at least, you know, 60% of vacant calendar are hardly getting anything done. All they're doing is talking and creating distractions for themselves. And they get so used to it that off work, they start doing it with friends. You know, we either fill our calendars professionally or we fill our calendars socially. We just do not spend time with ourselves. And if we start doing that, you will see that you realize how quick you reach towards a solution simply because you sat down to think about it.
Right, that's right. So I understand your inspiration, sort of, I would say inspiration, is coffee in today's day and age. But in your college days, who was the person you looked up to?
I don't know, man. So I was hugely inspired by music, and I was academically very, very poor. I wasn't really into studies as such, but, you know, logic kind of appealed to me. My entire reason for applying for bachelor's, so I did my bachelor's from Khalsa College in Chandigarh. But before it opened up in Chandigarh, it was actually in Shimla. So my entire reason for filing up for BCA was so that I could run away from home and, you know, go to Shimla and spend 3 years there. You know, how wonderful would that be?
Hmm.
Unfortunately, it kind of opened up and my dad said, no, you're doing it in Chandigarh itself. Why do you have to go to Shimla? So I didn't have any sense of direction, so to speak. But I think that kind of helped, you know. I used to listen to a lot of singers at that point in time. You had the Princes and the Michael Jacksons of the world who were doing some great music. And I would wonder, you know, how could they be one with their skill? I mean, I don't know if you've recently seen any Michael Jackson performances, but the guy would just be music himself when he would be on stage. And more than the music itself, that flow state used to really inspire me that, oh, what would it feel like if you were just one with your skill or with the work that you're doing? And I see that in a lot of places now. I actually experience this when I'm making coffee. I get so engrossed into it, I just hardly realize my own presence. You would see somebody who's doing pottery when they're actually doing it. They become one with that particular skill. And that flow state is meditative. It's something that helps you, you know, gain peace and enjoy the journey. And that is what I think most of us are failing to do these days. We don't actually want to get into a flow state. We, you know, don't want to lose ourselves there, but we'd rather stay distracted. But, you know, so I think very early on in my life, I kind of developed this sense of identifying people in flow states, and I would just aspire to be able to accomplish it. So I tried various things, you know. So I picked up some crappy book on meditation. I don't know if that was a wise thing to do at that point in time. And I would lock myself in the room and think, okay, maybe this is the way to nirvana.
Okay.
And then, you know, I went into music and then started singing and then thought, okay, maybe this is the way to do it. Then I kind of went into dancing and then I went through a lot of others at that point in time. Actually, in my 12th, I picked up Guru Granth Sahib and I kind of ended up reading the full translation of it, you know, thinking that this could help me sort of, you know, reach that flow state. So I experimented a lot with those different things that kind of made sense to me at that point in time. In fact, reading through these scriptures kind of made me a little religious and also superstitious to a certain extent, where I would feel that if I don't read this today, something bad would happen. But then, you know, it would happen.
Oh.
If I would not read Guru Granth Sahib that day, you know, something bad would happen. So over time, I realized that, you know, my belief setup and my mind is so strong that, you know, all I need to do is kind of stay put on finding that flow state and maybe self regulating myself to what I want to do and achieve in life rather than sort of following these various techniques. So not specifically any one person or anyone that I would sort of find as ideal, but I think through these experiments and finding patterns in people, that is something that, you know, kept me going. And I've done a lot. I've failed a lot. Like I said before, even I did my post-graduation, I had failed a startup. And that also taught me a lot about emotions. I mean, firing people is not easy. And I had to let go of people at that point in time. And I was like, I just finished my graduation. So I had no experience of that, of how to let go of people and letting people down, you know. I mean, making them feel as if they're not wanted anymore, making them feel rejected. But looking back, they're all sitting in the Microsofts and the Facebooks of the world today. And that makes me feel good. That little experience also helped.
But the kind of journey you have shared today makes me understand that you are someone who is willing to take risks, who is ready to fail. And that is more important than having a mindset to only succeed.
Yeah, Shivangi, funny you mentioned that. It's something that you realize, but you kind of realize it late in life. So, I mean, think about this. When you did you fail? Failure always comes before success, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the order in which things happen. When you were learning to ride a bike, did you just start riding it straight away? Or did you fail a couple of times dropping off it?
Mm.
So, you know, over time, I think, and specifically, I feel academics, the way it functions in India, the schooling system is to be blamed for it. We are then taught that failure is not an option. And that's where things kind of go a little south, in my opinion.
Hmm.
as a kid, you knew this particular aspect of life, that it's okay to fail. You know, that's the way to learn. But as we grow old, our schooling system teaches us it's not okay to fail, you know, and that's not how you should survive. People will judge you. And they do, because they have also gone through the same. They're also schooled the same way. So, you know, people who are judging you, who you are ashamed of, have also experienced the same in their lifetime. So they think that's the way to live. But if you look at a science lab, nobody, that's the only place I know where failure is acceptable. You can go and sort of blast something before you find something important and still get away with it. So why is that not applicable to all the aspects of our life is something that I think is kind of surgically that kind of is removed from our personalities as we grow old and as we go through our schooling system. So risk taking, I think, is not just something that I am sort of, you know, I feel extremely scared about taking certain risks. Intelligence plays a part in making it more calculated, right? So that you don't end up either hurting yourself or hurting others. And that's what calculated risks are for. But, you know, that is everybody's core DNA. We are just programmed over time to go against that core. So you know, when you start going back into that again, you will realize you enjoy the journey as well, get the results. And your expectations also become realistic.
Yeah. Expectations realistic, that I think is the most important part of any journey that we might take.
Absolutely. I mean, I read this equation somewhere, so it's like a mathematical formula that happiness is equal to results minus expectations. Now, if the expectations are higher, your happiness is going to go into negative. Right. If your results are higher, then your happiness is going to go into positive. But the key here is you hold the key for happiness. And if that's your ultimate goal, then might as well work towards realistic expectations and work towards results rather than you know, just keeping your expectations high.
Makes sense. I think they taught this equation in school, along with Pythagoras' theorems.
If they would had, it would have been good. Actually, people are not focused on... I think the biggest problem our workforce in India suffers from today is poor financial planning. And also the definition of enough. I think if in our schooling systems, you know, it is taught how to stay financially intelligent, people will realize... So for example, let me ask you this question, Shivangi. How much money do you need to be happy?
Essentially, you just need the amount of money which would fulfill your necessities, the food, the clothes, and a house to stay in. Apart from that, it's all our demands.
Yeah. Can you give me a figure?
I think depends on where you're living, what kind of lifestyle you're leading. The lifestyle I'm currently leading, I think 30K a month is okay for me.
See, that 30K a month is fine. Okay. So let's say you're working for the next 20 years. If you do the math, you know, you're looking at maybe 2-3 crores. In total,
probably
5 crores. Yeah. If I give that money to you today, what are you going to do?
Oh, I am a wise person. I would invest it.
See, the point I was trying to make here is you can only know that it's enough if you know how much you want. Financially, if you go out and ask people how much they want, they will not have an answer to that question. So that is what I meant, that people keep chasing ghosts. This is something that I realized when my financial advisor asked me this question.
Nice.
And I was like, oh shit, actually, I don't really know how much I want. So you are actually running after the perception of reaching financial independence without actually calculating what will fetch you that financial independence.
Right.
I think if you look at our even older generation, so I come from a family where my parents are actually in working class. They've been working government jobs and all. And that's understandable. Post-partition, you know, job security was a fundamental criteria. It wasn't. Risk-taking wasn't really an option. But, you know, you will realize that financial planning is not taught anywhere. It's not taught in... You can learn about economics. You can learn about wealth management and stuff like that. But it's simple maths. You got income, expense. You got assets and liabilities. Assets are supposed to make you passive income. How many of us are actually thinking about money making us money? And if that is sorted, wouldn't you... just stay focused on growth. So my second question to you was, what if I give that money to you today? Now, again, you're thinking about making more money from that money. Okay, that's fine. But what would you do with your life?
Hmm.
That is something would be extremely unfortunate if people die without exploring. So, you know, money, yes, is important for survival. And actually, it's a function of financial intelligence, which we never learn.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, we take away this opportunity of true growth away from ourselves, which is the ultimate thing needed for happiness. So we rip ourselves from happiness purely because we are not financially sound. We are not financially intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if our schooling systems incorporates basics of financial planning, and I'm only talking four terms, income, expense, keep your expenses lower than incomes, and assets and liabilities. Assets are stuff that grows money for you. Liabilities is that takes money away from you.
Hmm.
You would lead a lot more happier life because you're not chasing an unrealistic goal for yourself and things are taken care for you while you focus on what you really are passionate about. Most of us are not doing our passion because we think we've got this burden of earning.
Hmm. I am chasing my passion, but sometimes I sit back and think maybe I should have done something else in order to get more money, which is a bad loop.
So again, if you were getting enough in what you are doing as your passion, you would probably not be thinking.
But it's never enough, no? Like you said.
Well, it is enough. If you will realize that once you buy the car of your choice, once you have traveled business class or first class, once you've stayed in 5-star hotels and you know it becomes a norm to eat, you know, in these 5-star places, you would realize that you will enjoy chai wala thela more than actually having, you know, some fancy dinner somewhere. You would realize that you started moving towards more simpler ways of living life than what you had really aspired for.
Hmm.
Or if you have to turn back to the same thing, then, you know, you would realize that enough was just me experiencing it. All you need to do is fly that business class once. All you need to do is stay in a 5-star once. And you know what? You can even do that today if you are financially intelligent. It's not out of our means.
I think a balance plays a major role in all this. Like it keeps your brain satisfied and your heart satisfied. You do both, but in equal measures and in a measure that allows your pocket. So you don't overexpend yourself and you don't undervalue yourself. It's just there.
Correct. Just stay logical. See, in this era of instant gratification, where if you want food, you know, order it on Zomato, it will be there for you. You want something to, you know, wear, you'll order it on Amazon, you'll immediately get it for you. If you want a fancy holiday, I'll spend it on my credit card. If you want a fancy, you know, travel experience, I'll spend it on credit. So actually working towards what you want and satisfying that goal intelligently through financial intelligence is I think, one of the ways forward rather than seeking instant gratification. I mean, I was seeing a very funny video the other day as to why do middle class actually are spending so extravagantly on their weddings.
Hmm, right.
I mean, if you look at a superstar, when they actually, you know, get married, let's say the rich who are ultra rich, you know, they go back to their palaces, they don't go on rent into their 2 BHK apartments after getting married. And why so many fancy setups on clicking, you know, their photographs, something that you would never even see again. If a rock star does it, they are actually earning royalty on those photographs. What the hell is the middle class earning from it? And you know what? These days, you will realize when you go to weddings, the worst part is the food, which is the actual reason why people should be there. So they don't spend enough on food, but they spend on stupid stuff and then get under a lot of debt, which to me is not financial intelligence. So you get married, which is good. It's a dream, ultimate dream. You want to feel rich for 3 days and then spend the next 20 years
Making work.
Makes no financial sense to me. I know of couples who don't even, who cannot even afford to go out on a nice honeymoon because they've spent so much money on their wedding.
Right. The house help we have has had her daughter's wedding very recently. And she was very worried that how am I going to get so much money from where would I get the sum? How would I arrange everything? And I told her, do a small marriage, auntie. Matlab, it's okay. And she's like, no, beta, what would the people say? If I have ate in other people's weddings, I need to have a extravagant wedding where they can come and eat and give blessings. And I don't understand the circle of the society. Why do you have to come into the scenario of give and take?
Yeah, and also this is where upholding your social identity comes at a cost of your actual lifestyle. So whoever they is, you know, quote unquote, they are doing it for, are they going to be there when you need them?
They won't even help you repay the loan.
Correct. Yeah. And they are the ones who will come to you and say, why the hell did you spend it if you didn't have it?
Exactly.
They will make you feel stupid.
Hmm.
They. So, you know, running after they is just a psychological thing. There is no they. You know, this is a perception we picked up from Bollywood movies where some aunties in the corner would chuckle around and make you feel stupid. In reality, that never happens. Have you seen anywhere that happening?
There are people who judge, but that doesn't happen.
See, if people judge you, they are not worth being in your life. So you made a wrong choice if you were still doing things to please them.
Hmm.
But again, we've kind of diverted off track, but it's these kind of things that kind of, you know, lays down the path of your professional career. Because of these poor choices, we want more money. Because we want more money, we, you know, define our growth as just being economic prosperity. And as a result of that, you know, we either end up chasing that ghost our entire life and staying miserable.
Hmm.
Or, you know, we lose out on this opportunity of living a happy, fulfilled life, doing what we want by understanding what is enough and what true growth means to me. And I think if we close this gap in the industry, I mean, I know we are suffering from, you know, not finding the correct talent, tech talent for ourselves at times. And I think that's down to the fact that most of the young workforce, which is so talented, is completely misled. They are just lost. And it would be great if we could, if somebody, including ourselves, all the leaders, could help them understand how to stay financially intelligent. Because when that's out of the way, you will also realize whether you are an engineer or not. Most of us are into engineering because the packages are good, not because we like being engineers.
Right. I've come across such people.
That's true for every industry.
So if we come back to the main topic, I would ask for your preference. You have been into job and you have been an entrepreneur. What both have their benefits and cons, but what's your more preferred kind of the
way? It depends on what situation you are in life. I think I will get into a job and I don't need to make money. But if I need to make money, then I would be in the second or the third or preferably the fourth quadrant of wealth, if you are familiar with the wealth quadrant. So the first one is, you know, being employed. You work for someone and you get paid. You work 10 hours, you work 24 hours, but you only get paid for 8 hours, right?
Mm.
And you do that because you have some pseudo sense of security, not realizing that ultimately that is a business in itself. So if you think businesses are unstable, guess what? You are actually working for a business, right? With some pseudo sense of security. Right?
Mm.
The second quadrant is self-employed, which is a little better than the first one. If you work 8 hours, you get paid for 8 hours. If you work 20 hours, you get paid for 20 hours. At least you are getting paid for the amount of effort that you put. The third quadrant is running a business where other people make you money, right? Which is where, you know, the job aspect comes in. The people who are actually sitting at the top for a company that you're working for, they are making way more money than you are. And rightfully so. It's not like, you know, they're trying to exploit, but they are holding responsibilities for so many employees within the company. They are holding the responsibility of securing them to a certain extent. But eventually, it's a business. It goes through the same cycles of ups and downs. It's got same factors that affect it externally or internally, whether it's union, whether it's war, whether it's COVID. You know, they all get affected by it. But that's the third quadrant where somebody makes you money, right? And then the fourth quadrant is like, you know, money makes money. So you, like you mentioned, if I give you $5, you invest it and then money makes you money. That is the ultimate journey which should stay for everyone professionally. You should stay in the first quadrant while you're trying to acquire a skill and understand the ways of working.
Mm-hmm.
Then you should experiment with going into the second quadrant and try it out before you actually take on responsibility of others. You know, try to support yourself by being self-employed. Then go into the third quadrant where others make money for you. You take care of them, coach them, mentor them, make them grow. Because for them, it's the first quadrant. And then once you made enough, you go into the fourth quadrant. And then, I don't know, become a philanthropist or something.
Sounds like a good journey of life, the way you put
it. Yeah,
that.
Fortunately, we all keep ourselves stuck in the first quadrant, which is unfortunate.
Makes sense. So I also understand the fact that Everything that you've said is very enlightening. I have not had such an enlightening conversation with anyone until now. So, from what I have learned in life, you are more of a reader than a watcher. Am I right? Reading the book and watching the TV.
Okay, all right. From a content consumption point of view, all right, yes. Well, that's not true. But yes, my type of reading is a little different. So, I draw inspiration from reading, guidance or self-help related books, or I finished Atomic Habits. I read a lot of books on financial planning. I'm currently reading The Psychology of Money. Then I also sort of, these are the kind of books and biographies that I love to read, because then it kind of helps me tap into some patterns that is out there in the world, and not specifically, this has been me being true to the way I used to operate before. Watching, yes, I consume. I love watching, food shows. I love watching car review shows. So, content consumption, yes, is there. But typically at the end of the day, when, it's like time for you to sort of retire and not do anything. But these days, for sure, my reading is more than watching.
So, would you suggest any books? Would you recommend any books?
Definitely. I would... hugely recommend people, this is sort of, might sound like a cliche, Rich Dad Poor Dad, read The Psychology of Money. Then there are loads of books. So for example, there is this book called The First 90 Days. It's actually sitting in front of me by Michael Watkins. This is a book that I would highly recommend. People specifically in the first quadrant who are doing their jobs. One thing that I've realized reading this book is that how instruction-led we become as a workforce. We are waiting for somebody to tell us what to do, and we kill our own intuition as a result of that. First 90 days kind of helps you, take charge of your own role and your own deliverables. So rather than waiting for your leader or your manager or your boss to tell you what to do, you go back to them and say, I think I should do this. What do you think? It creates a sense of proactiveness and also allows you to set realistic goals for yourself rather than somebody telling you something unrealistic. So that was pretty interesting. And I've read a lot of, I pretty much read everything that Devdutt Patnaik has made. He's written a lot of books on how he's compared the philosophies of mythology, Indian mythology, Hindu mythology, with practices in businesses. There is Business Sutra. There is a Leadership Sutra that he's written. My personal favorite is My Gita, which is his perception on and his take on Gita. Most of my principles about not judging people has come from that book and has been an eye-opener. And I have distributed that book. A lot of people probably bought like 30 books and distributed it away to people I felt might be in need of it. I think reading, definitely Atomic Habits is a great framework of how to develop habits, how to identify yourself, how habits are something that you do subconsciously. It's not something that you do consciously. So how do you get into that mode of doing something that helps you rather than doing something that harms you? And how to get rid of bad habits is definitely one. The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck is also my all-time favorite. The Art of Being Disliked, the list is endless. And I am a huge fan of design thinking philosophies because they are the ultimate sort of problem solving frameworks. How do you create personas? How do you create a sense of empathy chart to understand what kind of problems they are facing and then design a solution around it, which creates value? It's a great framework to look at. But I'm not too hugely into fiction. I'm more into these kind of books. There's a very simple book that came on financial planning by an author called Monica Allen. Let's Talk Money is the name of the book that she wrote. And I think that was my first exposure towards financial planning. It kind of made sense. And post that, Diamonds in the Dust. I would hugely recommend things that help you improve you as a personality. Atomic Habits is definitely one of my recommendations, which will help you create habits for yourself that you benefit from. And My Gita is definitely something that is like my go-to book.
I think I'm going to get these two because I started my reading journey through self-help books. But during the journey, I kind of wandered from the path and I started reading any XYZ kind of books, but I might go back to them.
Yeah, I think the Atomic Habits kind of will help in these kind of situations when you kind of deviate. You will get a nice sort of framework with which you can bring that thing back into your life again and come back on track. So it's a combination of different books that kind of help you. But again, you know, it's a very subjective thing.
Right. On that wise note of good habits, I think we shall wrap up. It has been a wonderful conversation with you. I have learned so much, subconsciously and consciously both. So thank you for your time. It was lovely.
Thank you, Shivangi. This was wonderful. I mean, you've helped me recap my entire journey, and it's kind of been nostalgic, and I felt really good about you know, how this journey has happened, and it's all thanks to the show and to you, Shivangi. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It was wonderful. I have a few questions around your journey. As how much international exposure helps you as a person and helps you create everything around you? Can you, in brief, tell us about that as well? Because that's something we have not tapped.
Oh, I think it creates a huge impact. So, aapne wo kahawat suni hogi, toye ka daddu, right?
No.
Nahi suni? Okay.
No.
So, but you understand what I'm saying, right?
Kuwe ka mendak.
Haan, aise keh lijiye. Punjab mein thoda toye ka daddu bol dete hain usko. But essentially, if you are not exposed to the various possibilities that are out there, right? You can't, this is a global village. You've got a, people always think of making money in dollars. They don't think of making money in rupees anymore. When you've got to operate like that, you've got to understand people's way of working. And, you know, traveling in particular from that aspect is a great, great learning experience. I don't know if you've noticed, but jitne bhi bade peer paigambar hue hain, aap unme ek cheez common dekhoge, they've all traveled.
Right.
And they have gained experience of different ways of life, different cuisines, culinary experiences, different styles of working, different forms of relationship management. So all of this kind of exposure helps you relate. So if I'm working with somebody in US, you know, their sense of irony is very different from somebody who operating in UK. And being comical or cracking a joke could also either bring you close to someone or, you know, make them think, what the hell are you talking about? So understanding, gaining exposure helps build relationships globally.
Right.
And once you understand their lifestyle and their working style, you can sort of morph yourself to accommodate and also help them understand and identify the way you operate. So it's a mutual learning experience, not just for us, but also for them. And that kind of creates a synergy, and wherever there is synergy, it creates a nice coherent environment of growth. I think my travel experiences before I went to the UK to study were pretty limited, but once that happened, I traveled quite a bit extensively in the Middle East. I've traveled a lot in Southeast Asia. I've traveled quite extensively to US for my work. And working with them has taught me a lot about their lifestyle, and that has helped me grow professionally.
Perfect. That's amazing. So we have now covered all the questions that I had for you in mind, and I hope you had fun.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you for this opportunity, Shivani. Thank you so much.
We shall reconnect in case any such opportunity comes up.
I'll be looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for your time. So that's about it. I hope you had a good infotaining experience in this conversation just as much as I did. And if you have any query, questions, suggestion for us, drop them at www.codequotient.com. That's all for today. We'll meet again soon. Till then, keep coding, keep learning, and keep fixing the bugs.
Fixing. Fixing the bugs.
Powered by Code Quotient.